He recently retired, but he is one hell of a teacher. So that kind of presentation, properly done, is about time that we change the way we teach the antenna science, because everybody wants wireless products. We want our keyboard and our display to be wireless. We want all the control of all the appliances in the house to be wireless. Wireless, wireless, wireless. And it can't be done without antennas. And the way the antenna companies in the United States operate is that their whole philosophy in life is they hope the computer program they use is accurate. Let me drop. And their whole philosophy was we model it first, then we build it. Good sounding philosophy, it almost works for them. Of those 30 patents that I have filed, more than half of those could not have been found that way. In fact, some of the most high performance designs I've worked on, the currently available computer antenna modeling programs do not work on those antennas. You make an antenna with conductors that are really wide because you want broad bandwidth. And therefore, the computer programs are forced to do a whole lot of breaking it up into little bitty triangles. What is that called now? Can't think of the name of the concept. Anyhow, it's got a break in
finite element analysis.
Thank you. Those are the right words, Lou. It has to break it up into such a large number of finite element analysis, individual triangles, and all of those have to be in a great big complex matrix that has to be inverted multiple times, and the computer program cannot handle that. And yet, you take one simple little ham radio philosophy-like guy, K2LIW, let me drop. That guy standing in front of a real good antenna, a vector network analyzer made by Roden Schwartz, which is the modern-day equivalent of a Diswar measuring machine. It just gives you the resistive component and the reactive component and a nice big Smith chart display. But here I am with a visual measuring component with a philosophy in my head as to how the signal is bouncing back and forth throughout these various white pieces of sheet metal. And on this 3-foot-long antenna range, I'm tweaking this with handheld tools, and I find the solution in the real world without these fancy computer models. And the computer model to try to model that antenna take a couple of hours computing to come up with a partial answer of what I've already got the answer of. And by way of the tweaking I can do, I can test 10 antenna designs in a 4-hour period. And the computer program to try to model each one of those antennas takes 4 hours to model one of them and comes up with an answer that's only 50% correct. Which is the right way to do it. As you can tell, we ain't doing it right. So as such, every one of those antenna companies in the United States that has the philosophy of we model it first, then we build it, would not have found most of the antenna designs that I have found. The tools they're using can't handle that yet. So, yes, Eric, you've got a damn good solution. And I guess I got to follow through with that one. Any final words on this one, Eric? What's the next step? KE2EJ? K2LIW? K2LIW,
K2EJ. How much do you want to bet that if we go to a road support, or we go to an Agilent, and we show them our proposal for creating this educational piece of material? By the way, you need to step up to the plate. I mean, you do talk about it an awful lot. I mean, the only thing it's going to really cost you is time. And you'd get a lot of really good stuff out of it. And you'd be doing something, you'd be really leaving your mark on the world. Actually, I do know a couple of getting very old antenna designers, like Leonard Ogev, who designed the master antenna system that was on the World Trade Center for the broadcasters. He's got his own consulting company now. And a few other people. We could probably, you know, if we put together a decent proposal, not only could we put something together, we'd probably get funding to do it, to make the whole thing worthwhile. And I don't know if you've ever been to iTunes University, but it's not YouTube. You should go there. And my refresher course in calculus, there's this guy, I can't think of his name. Let me let it drop. He goes through the calculus course in little 5-minute bits. He does it in a way that it is amazingly fun and incredibly clear. Even the most complex things, he explains it in such a way that, you know, a 10-year-old can follow it. So, there is no reason why we can't leave our mark on the world and help make it a better place for the things that we see that are lacking. But it takes a little effort, it takes a desire, and it takes a want to do something like that. And only you can find the answer to that. K2RIW, K2J.
I hear you, Eric. We've got to talk. There's a huge room for improvement. Wes, go ahead and keep it a little bit brief if you can. Go ahead, Wes.
Dick, supposedly there was a guy who was having plenty of wealth, plenty of money, and eventually he died. Because during his lifetime, somebody asked him, can you use this money? And I said, nah. But he created a fund, and there was no authorization to anybody, so everything was lost. He was a total loser. The reason I'm telling you that is because you're sitting on the wealth of information. And you're sitting on the wealth of something that is needed by others. And eventually, like everybody else, I'm going to die, you're going to die, everybody's going to die. You're going to be a total loser. Because you didn't put it on paper, you didn't make any videos, you didn't make anything that it would be left after. Well, yes, publication. But I would say better is to see than is to read. That's my opinion. I mean, Dick, I completely agree with John, and I agree with Eric. The knowledge that you have is a volume, tremendous one. And to agree.
Thank you for the compliment. And what you're hearing did not come from the schools. Of all the schools I've gone to, it seems to me like 5% of it goes into what I know about antenna design. I've been through what I think is a 40-year apprenticeship of working with the antenna department at Airborne Instruments Laboratory for 35 years. I wasn't hired by the antenna department. And by the way, Henry Jasek, as he was leaving the company, so to speak, he said, gee, I wish I had hired you. And I said, why? He says, that way I would have been able to control you, because you gave me a lot of flack. There were times when his antenna engineers were proposing things that I knew would be troublesome, and I wrote white papers saying so. And by way of those 40 or so years of apprenticeship, of working for people who really found out how to do it, not from the schools, by being exposed to the world's largest antenna chamber at Edwards Air Force Base, being exposed to the world's best antenna range at the Rome Air Development Center in Utica, New York. By way of those exposures and by way of what I've done as a consultant to write these patents and build these antennas that are being used, yeah, there's a lot of hands-on experience you're listening to. It's not high IQ, it's curiosity. Let me drop. One of the things that they used to say about Harold Wheeler is that one of the geniuses at, I think it was Hazeltine Corporation, he was chairman of the board for a while. People used to say that Harold seems to know how that radio wave feels as it goes down that waveguide. He could predict the way it's going to behave when it goes through that L bend and that Magic T hybrid and whatever built-in waveguide. He understood the way that wave felt going down that waveguide. And to a small degree, I'd like to believe I know how that wave feels when it bounces back and forth on that dipole. And I'm extremely disappointed. Of the 35 books I own on antennas, not one of them says the signal is going to bounce back and forth 20 times. Not one of them says that if you're building an antenna, you resonate it first, then it can radiate. That's the bedrock. And none of those books say that. None of the courses in the school say that. Because the people didn't understand it. They never got past the crazy way that we're taught, and they thought that somewhere built into those equations was the answer. Absolutely not. Let me drop. Almost all of those equations are somebody coming up with a curve-fitting equation that met the requirement. Very little of that is a real derivation. It's based on hands-on empirical measurement and a curve-fitting equation. And another one of my philosophies is what we call a TEM wave in a piece of coaxial cable. Absolutely, TEM wave is there. You really do have a center conductor, an outer conductor. You really do have electrons flowing. You really do have an E field and an H field. Current is flowing, you're making magnetic field. It's all there inside the coax cable. And now you jump into free space. The upper conductor and the lower conductor is not there. The electrons are not there. When you transmit that signal out of an antenna, not one single electron leaves that antenna. The only thing that leaves that antenna is a magnetic field. That magnetic field, when it hits on reception, your particular piece of wire that you call an antenna, by Faraday's law, it induces a voltage into your antenna. The magnetic field did that, just like the secondary winding of your transformer. The changing rate of the magnetic field induces a voltage. Not one single electron leaves the primary of your transformer and goes into the secondary. And yet the voltage gets there, by Faraday's law. I think there is no E field in space. There's nothing but the magnetic field. There's a whole philosophy of that. I built a whole lot of antennas using that philosophy, and for me, it works. Is it right? I'm not sure, but for me, it works. Okay, we've been on the subject long enough, and the emotion involved, as you can tell, is reasonably high. We're way beyond the point when I should have turned it over to John for the mailbag. And John, these very curious guys who mail letters to you with these fantastic questions, what have you received this week? KC2WGB, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Y2HF, Dennis, with a comment.
Okay, stand by for a second, John. Now, Dennis, the greenest guy we know way out there, let that beep go by. The greenest guy we know way out there in Kutchuk. What would you like to say, Jen, Dennis? NY2HF, KQRIW.
I wanted to second what Wesley said. We have a wealth of information, and, you know, I'm lucky. I'm out here with Jay, and he just amazes me all the time with his knowledge. I think you really should take Eric up on the offer to put this stuff out there and have it out there for everybody, you know, in the future. I just think that... you know, it's one thing it's in your head. It's another thing if somebody else can use it, you know, later on. So, you know, my hat's off to you. You know, you're brilliant for what you know. But, you know, there's generations of hams that are going to need this information. They're not going to get it from the schools. They really need to get it from you. Back to Ned.
Yeah, thank you, Dennis. The J he's talking about is a guy now known as NY2NY, J. Buscemi. He used to be for many, many years K2OBS. J and I, K2OBS, were roommates in college. We both went to the same school, Pratt Institute. We then both went to the same company, Airborne Instruments Laboratory. And that Airborne Instruments Laboratory, in its heyday, that was one hell of a college. You think it was a company. It was a college. Those guys were in the real world of pure research of the wireless world of radar in particular, antennas, rotary joints, and whatever. Just walking around that building and talking to people and watching the experiments that were going on and whatever. And what the president of the company used to do, John Clark, would periodically go to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and he would say something like these words. Let me drop. His words were something along the lines of, I got a bunch of these really smart geniuses in the wireless world and in the radio world back there in Deer Park. They can create anything you want. Tell me what you want. I'll have my guys make one of them for you. We'll hand it to you. And if you like it, you can then say, okay, how many more do you want us to build and what is it going to cost? He did that on multiple occasions, and boy, did it work. So Jay and I had one hell of a lucky apprenticeship by working for that company in its heyday. Unfortunately, in the later days, the bean counters started taking over and the philosophy changed. But my goodness, was that one hell of a school. And one of the guys who invented stripline, Henry Keene, taught me stripline. And the net result was the stripline antenna tripler, was the antenna, here we go, stripline 2 meter, 440-32 supplying tripler, followed by the parallel kilowatt amplifier. I worked with a guy named Henry Jasek, and he and I crossed horns on a number of occasions as to how you can get maximum gain out of a Yagi antenna. Smart guy, but we differed a little bit in a friendly way. And I had a chance to work with him and Dave Bressler, his genius in the back room, if you know what I mean, that was really doing an awful lot of the real calculations of the antennas. So when it comes to some of the giants in the world of wireless, Jay and I had the lucky circumstance of working for that company at that period of time when they were doing that work and talking to them. And boy, I look back on that as the so-called good old days, if you know what I mean. All older guys start saying those words. You've got to be careful. Hey, John, you better start giving us another one of these questions. KC2WGB. Thank you, Dennis. KQRIW. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Paul, everybody on the net. Dick, it sounds to me like it's incumbent on you to start drawing up an outline for the syllabus that you're going to need. And I think you're going to need a big one. Let me let it drop. I've won the first question.
Let me say two things before you go on.
Go ahead, Eric.
If you're really serious about this, okay, you have to put a little thought behind it. But what we need to do is to make a presentation to people like Roger Schwartz, Agilent, some people I know at MIT. If we're really serious about this, you need a little bit of power behind it, so to speak. Because to make something like that happen, we could do it for free, but you're going to need the stuff that you need to really do an excellent job of presentation. If we can get some folks behind it, some grant money, it could be very much worth our while. What I'm talking about probably shouldn't be said on ham radio, but it's something to think about. So, put some serious thought into it. Let me know what you think, because I can make this kind of thing happen. And it would be interesting to have it happen. So there you go. Now, go to your mailbag, which is late. KQRIWK.
Very fine, Eric. Lately, we're always late. We get stuck on these interesting subjects. And my ability to be brief is rather poor. Go ahead, John. KC2WGB. Thank you, Eric. KQLIW listening. You got it, John.
Yeah, we're running a little late, Dick. All right. First question comes from a young amateur who has the ability. Well, he has a 100-watt, 2-meter transmitter, transceiver, and he also has some UHF equipment. He wants to get into moon bounce, and he doesn't want to waste money. What should he acquire first? How should he go about starting off? Should he just try to listen to some moon bounce to see what he needs, or do you have an idea of what he should purchase to get started? That's basically his answer, and he's really very interested in this. He's heard a lot about it. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Of all the things that ham radio operators do, EME, Earth, Moon, Earth, Moon Bounce, is arguably one of the most difficult, most challenging things that they've done in the past. And by way of WSJT, weak signal Joe Taylor techniques, computer processing receiver techniques, it has become, let me pick a number, 10 dB or 15 dB easier than it ever was in the past. But still, it's very challenging. Now, if a ham radio operator in the old days was going to build a piece of electronics, what he frequently would do in his craftiness is he would look at his junk box and say, what components have I got that can possibly be applied to this synthesis problem? He puts all those components on the table and he starts designing a circuit around it. And that way the minimum amount of parts have got to be purchased. That's a very crafty way of doing it. Let me drop. So before I make a recommendation to the guy as to what he should buy, there's got to be even one step before that, John, and that is to do a bit of a research. If you go to the website of Alan Katz, K2UIH, K2 Uniform Yankee Hotel. He has for 35 years been publishing the essentially monthly journal, which is really a lunar monthly journal, called EME News. And if you look at some of those past issues, you want to find out of all the guys, there's probably 1,000 guys on planet Earth who have done moon bounce, very rough approximation. Each of them have had probably 8 or 10 different methods of doing it, and various little variations on that. If you look at the past history, and you say, well, a great big phased array, that looks like a lot of work, it takes a lot of area, I don't want to build that. A great big feed horn, I don't want to do that. A parabolic dish, maybe I want to do that. Or maybe I only need a couple of Yagis and the WSJT program. There's a whole lot of decisions you got to make in the very beginning. If I'm going to take a trip from New York to California, do I do it by air, by boat, by car? Do I take the northern route, the southern route? There's a whole lot of decisions you got to make as to what for you is the best way and the amount of time and the amount of dollars you get to get from New York to California. To start hearing your echoes off the moon and start talking to people that are doing this. Let me drop. You want to look at the track record of the guys who are doing it now. You want to start reading their articles. You start Googling the right words. You go to the microwave website of Tom Williams, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org. And he's got on one of his pages a list of other references. And you go to those other references. And a number of these guys have got, they've been doing moon bounce for 15 years, and they've made a beautiful website with photographs as to how they did it. I mean, one of those guys happens to be in Alaska, out in the real outback, who's doing it. Some of those guys are in Japan, some of those guys are in Australia, some of those guys are in Belgium, Germany, England, whatever, Florida, Hawaii. You look at some of the past ways those guys have done it, and one of those ways is going to say, boy, that looks like fun. I'd love to build that kind of an antenna. I'd like to listen to those echoes off the moon. 250,000 miles round trip, 250,000 miles one way, 500,000 miles round trip roughly. Let me drop. At the speed of light, it takes 2.5 seconds for that signal to go there and come back. I mean, some of this could really light up your enthusiasm when you look at what other people have done. So before you decide what to buy, make sure you've done enough research as to the guys with a good track record, what have they done, and which one turns you on. Now, there's something else you've got to even zoom back a little bit further and find out what is your philosophy of life on this one. Let me show you what I mean. If I was real interested in astronomy, and this was the year 1960, I got very few choices. To get a mirror big enough to really turn on your enthusiasm, you got to grind your own mirror. Once you decide to grind your own mirror, you've dedicated a year of your life to do that. It doesn't happen overnight. There's a whole lot of zillions of steps in there that are going to be very carefully done. Here we are in the year 2013, and now that mirror that used to take you a year to build, you can now buy it with 1 week's salary, maybe 3 days' salary. So now if you're real interested in astronomy, you've got to make a decision. Am I interested in the mirror grinding process and the process of building the telescope? Is that what turns me on? Or do I want to look at stars? If so, write a check and the problem goes away. If I want to get into astrophotography, do I buy a real good camera that I connect to that telescope? Do I go to a real dark area to use it? Or do I, there's various ways you can do it. You can make decisions that are higher and lower in dollars, higher and lower in time, higher and lower in the individual steps that you enjoy. You've got to make a decision. What step is the one that you enjoy? So I'm recommending you do a whole lot of research before you buy anything. But there's one other thing I got to tell you. Let me drop. Unless you're willing to become one of the really big guns, a big gun is a guy with a 28-foot dish on 1296. And when he aims that dish at the moon, and he's talking to another 28-foot dish, he's one of the guys that gets a strong enough signal that he can hold a real QSO off the moon. He's sending voice signals back and forth. But that's a lot of resources to build that network to be that big gun. So it's 1,500 watts at the dish, half a dB of noise figure at the dish, a 28-foot dish with accurate azimuth elevation, tracking network that can really track the moon, track the sun, and whatever. And he can also do beautiful radio astronomy with that. Do you want to go that far to become a big gun where you can really hold voice communication? The answer is very few do that. I can count them on one hand, worldwide. The average guy builds something a hell of a lot less in which he's listening to an extremely weak CW signal in the noise. As such, that really weak CW signal in the noise allows you to eventually confirm a set of call letters, eventually confirm a signal strength report and a Rogers, and it's a valid QSO. And now you've talked to Japan. Now you've talked to Australia and whatever. You've talked to New Zealand by way of moon bounce. Let me drop. You've got the card on the wall, and you go on a list of people who have worked those particular countries and those particular zones. Yes, you've worked them. Yes, you got the minimum communication through. But as you can tell by what's going on this TechNet tonight, real conversation among similarly interested amateur radio operators, real conversation has to take place. With rare exception, moon bounce does not give you that communication. If you're doing the moon bounce as an adjunct to your operation, and you get on 2 meters and talk to people, and 440 and talk to people, and 80 meters and talk to people, and then you also do moon bounce, it can be successful. But if you put all of your effort into moon bounce, but you didn't go enough effort to be a big gun, you can only send weak signals to each other, and it's not real communication. You're alone, you've got some cards on the wall, but you didn't hold real communication. You didn't pick each other's brains. You didn't transfer information back and forth. A significant number of the guys who go into moon bounce, after 2, 3, 4 years, they become disappointed. They're not sure why they're not happy, but they haven't realized they're not happy because they weren't talking. They weren't really exchanging ideas. Oh, the sort of exchanging ideas. Let me drop. They put a monthly paragraph into this four-page journal every month in the EME News by K2UIH. And so by way of the written report of, I heard this guy, the signal strength, I heard that guy with the signal strength, I talked to this guy, I talked to that guy, except for that monthly report in the EME News, they're not really talking to people. Real ham radio operators in live communication want to pick each other's brain and say, I like this, I don't like that, I tried this, it worked, I tried that, it didn't work, this is how I modified this commercial antenna to get more performance out of it, and so on. We really are communicators. When you talk to that guy in Germany for the first time, you don't just say, hello, goodbye, send me a card, you're 5'9 in New York. If you've got any brains, you realize that real communication between human beings of very different societies have just taken place. And if you're smart enough, you ask him some crazy question like, when you walk out of the front door in the morning to go to work, you open the front door, tell me what you see. That's the beginning of a conversation among people of very different cultures in which real communication can take place. And whether or not you talk to each other about your Kenwood TS-711 transceiver on 2-meter all mode and the antenna you're connecting to, that's your choice. But real people of different cultures have the ability to talk to each other on a common language with a common interest if you've established the right kind of a communication channel by which they can really do it. And unless you become a super big gun, EME does not supply that. So you gotta look at these pitfalls in the beginning, in my opinion, because you could spend a lot of man hours, a lot of dollars, ending up doing something for 3 years that sort of works, and you got a lot of cards on the wall, but are you happy? Does it really please you? You gotta ask a couple of other rather deep philosophical questions, in my opinion, because it is a significant investment you're about to make in man hours and
repeater. Time out.
NY2HF for comment.
Dennis recognized him. You're about to make a rather big investment in man hours and dollars. Before Dennis decided that he was going to set up a photovoltaic system that made him have almost the capability of being independent of the grid, he had to look ahead before going down that road. Am I willing to spend that number of dollars? Am I willing to spend that number of man hours? Am I willing to spend the devote that many square meters of my real estate, of my property, of my roof, of my backyard, to establish the equipment to do that? Will I get enough return on investment? Will I get enough pleasure out of doing it? I know Dennis somewhat asked himself those questions before he went down that road. And he's reasonably happy with the results. Not everybody would be happy with that. NY2HF, KQRIW. Go ahead, Dennis. Tell us a little bit about your philosophy on this one.
Thank you, Dick. You do go down that road. You have to Rubik's Cube all the different variables, and you have to decide, you know, at the end of the day, it's a lifestyle choice. Because the initial investment may be great, but the payoff over time, over the next 30 years, is even better. And you got to hedge that the your electric rates are going to go up and not go down. So, it's been a wise investment. Do I wish I did it at a later time, now that they got the microinverters, where shading doesn't knock out the whole grid of panels, you know? Yeah, but that wasn't the time I made the decision. What I was going to say is, you were talking about moon bounce in reference to John's mailbag. I was thinking of Jay. I think Jay did a moon bounce on 222 megahertz. I don't know how he does it. You know, you two guys have got some amazing talent when it comes to all this stuff. I mean, I have a hard time programming my radio. I give it to Jay to do it. You know, you guys should actually get together and just pool your resources and really put something of quality out there for all these hams, because I'm telling you, you guys are the forefront on generation of hams, and we, the younger generation, we can't even shine a light to that. So, you know, we're not going to get it from other sources. So, it's up to you. Jay is my alma, you know, and then I think the world of the guy. You're going to get your information down on tape or down on paper, but, please get it down so everybody else can enjoy it. Back to net.
Yeah, I hear you, Dennis. When it comes to us getting together and pooling our resources, to a certain degree, you can say that's exactly what the TechNet has done for 31 years. All of this really smart brain power that exists in the northern New Jersey, southern New York, Long Island, eastern Connecticut area, we get together on Sunday night. It used to be 1 hour, now goes up to 4 hours, sometimes beyond. We are getting together and sharing real ideas. Jay and I were lucky enough to go to a pretty good school in his day. It's no longer an engineering school, Pratt Institute. Very unhappy about that. And we went to a very good company that was one hell of a teaching college about wireless. And I worked there for 35 years. I think he worked there for roughly 30 years. I walked out of school, walked into one company, and ended up retiring from that company 35 years later. And it's a darn good experience. So, yep, Jay did it on 220 megacycle. Let me drop. Jay really understands computers quite a bit better than I do. As such, he immediately grasped onto the Joe Taylor techniques, WSJT. By way of a computer modeling program, by way of its Reed-Solomon processing techniques and whatever, it now can tolerate a signal that's 28 dB below the noise and give you good information out of it. So with one or two Yagis and a solid-state brick amplifier in 220, Jay was doing moon bounce. He cannot hear the signal per se with his ears. He cannot hear his own echo. The computer program told him the echo just occurred, and the echo came from VE3 so-and-so, and this is his call letters, and that can print it across the screen. And so Jay has done some of that. He's not going to devote his whole life to it because it's not quite the kind of communication we're having right now. So by way of the WSJT program, a hell of a lot less hardware is required. In the old day, let me go. On the frequencies from 2 meters and above, about the only way you did moon bounce in the old days, you put up roughly 400 square feet of real antenna, 16 Yagis on 432, four very good long Yagis on 2 meters, for instance. You poured 1,500 watts into it, you used a half dB noise figure preamp right at the antenna, and you listen to these extremely weak signals in the noise of Morse code. And it's not a real conversation mode, but yes, you can eventually recognize those call letters, and the signal report and the Rogers, and it is a valid QSO, but it's not real communication. So Jay did that, but I can tell Jay has a little bit of my philosophy in that he wants to talk to people, and Moonbounce doesn't allow you to hold a real conversation. So I'm not trying to throw cold water on the idea of this guy who wrote to you, John, about what does it take to get Moonbounce and what should he do first. I'm just telling him to zoom back twice. Once to research on those who have done it, but even zoom back a little bit further and recognize his philosophy of life, filling up the wall with cards of people who he's got confirmed contacts with, but he didn't really hold a conversation with them. Would that please him? And if not, is he sure he really wants to go down that road? If he's doing a whole lot of communicating, let me drop it. If he's doing a whole lot of communicating on 80 through 10 meters, and maybe 6 meters, and 2 meters, and really talking to people, and also, as a sideline, doing Moonbounce, it can work like a charm. But if he puts 95% of his effort and dollars and man hours into only Moonbounce, and doesn't do the other communication, some of those guys end up with a divorce, they end up with displeasure, they didn't quite understand why they didn't get pleasure out of that. I mean, they did this thing that was sort of successful, and it didn't make them real happy, and they wonder why. And a significant number of the serious moon bouncers have ended up with a higher-than-normal divorce rate, in my opinion. With modern WSJT techniques, it doesn't have to be like that, but these are some of the pitfalls you have to know about ahead of time. So, as I said, I'm not trying to throw cold water. I'm just trying to let you know there's a little bit of a minefield here. And so tread a little bit carefully before really jumping into it with all your money and all of your man hours. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB with a little delay for our Canadian friends in case they're out there. Very good, Dick. Yeah, that's great information because I don't know his financial situation, but I think it's really very important that he do some research into maybe even communicate with some of these guys that are doing it on those websites. He could try talking to them possibly or emailing them, getting a feel for what they went through, where the pitfalls are, and that may be a lot of benefit for this guy. But at least he's interested. He let her drop. I'll go on to the next one. It's getting late, but I got to get this one in. KC2WGB.
I'm going to add another word here. Calling them, emailing them, writing them, that's a good approach. Roughly half of those guys who have done Moonbounce are kind of proud of what they've done. And if you write the right kind of an email and have the right kind of a conversation, a certain percentage of those guys are within driving this distance. Maybe you have to take a vacation to get there, but if you visit the guy's shack and see that antenna in the backyard, see the equipment he has set up, watch him doing a moon bounce, and you see it with your own eyes, boy, that'll give you an acquaintance to what it is that's better than any book or any YouTube video or iTunes University. If you see it with your own eyes, talk to the guy who's doing it by visiting his shack. Try to do that also, because you're about to invest enough money and time that it's worth visiting the guy who's doing it, maybe two or three of them. Some of these are fascinating people. The relationships you can establish by just finding a way of talking to these people and letting them be your elder or letting them tell you their philosophy of life, guarantees there's a lot to be learned there. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the Tech Man.
KC2WGB. Yeah, great idea, Dick. Visiting an actual site. Just like all the amateur astronomers and everybody else. Very good information. Well, I wish him success with that. Whether he'll do it or not, I don't know. Apparently he has the financing, but I think it's very important that he can check it out. Okay, let me let it drop and I'm going to go on to this great question. Okay, this young amateur is staying up. He's 13 years old, and he stays up for the entire show until midnight. Well, he's in a physics course, and he wants to know your explanation, if you have one, on the color of objects. And here's what he just went through, a little atomic theory and some electrons and protons, and he realizes that what an atom is supposed to look like. You know, he's got a concept, and he understands that protons are protons, electrons are electrons. Well, his question is, what makes the color when you put, say, carbon electrons, atoms together? You get black. Well, black is not a color, but you get a shade of something copper. You get a copper color. Well, the atom doesn't have color. It's made up of colorless items. Where does the color come from, Dick? Great question. Over to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, that is a darn good question. Your eye sees something. The sun creates light. Energy flows out of the sun. It comes down through the atmosphere, hits the objects in your backyard. The objects reflect certain frequencies. The light coming from the sun is so-called white. And by that I mean it starts off at very low frequencies of far infrared. The sun is generating those frequencies, near infrared, medium infrared, low optical, medium optical, high optical, in other words, red, green, blue, violet, and then ultraviolet, near ultraviolet, far ultraviolet. The sun is generating all of those frequencies. A certain significant percentage of those go through the atmosphere and hit the object in your backyard. Every object in the backyard has a certain spectrum of reflectivity. In other words, white light can be hitting your piece of gold in the backyard, and the gold object reflects the lower frequency red signals greater than the blue signals, the higher frequency signals. The gold just happens to, for molecular reasons, reflect those better. Your eye is a kind of optical spectrometer. Your eye does have cones, and the cones in your eye come in three flavors, red, green, and blue. Let me drop. So Mother Nature discovered a long time ago that when a human eye has color perception, it can easily tell the difference between a poisonous plant and a non-poisonous plant because of the difference in color, even though the leaves may be almost the same shape. So for survival reasons, color perception of a human being is extremely important. And you could say Mother Nature designed a optical spectrometer into that eye by way of the red, green, and blue cones. The cones come in three flavors. The cones give you the highest resolution near the center of the retina, and they can tell how much red, how much green, how much blue. And in the case of, if the two cones of red and green respond simultaneously, the eye puts them together and say, I think that's yellow. I know it's higher in frequency than red, lower in frequency than green. I think it's somewhere between yellow and orange. The brain and eye makes an interpretation, but that system can easily be fooled because was the object really yellow, or did the object really emit a certain amount of red and a certain amount of green, and the eye got fooled and called it yellow, and the yellow frequencies might not really be there. When Mr. Polaroid, with his land camera, came out with color perception, he came out with some fancy chemistry that fooled the eye into seeing those colors. Some of those colors on that Polaroid color picture are not really there. He recognized the good and the bad about the way the human eye works. I said good and bad. You know what I mean. It's a kind of a spectral. It is a triple filter kind of frequency spectrometer is what an eye is. Let me drop. And it can be fooled. And if your particular eye, if the red cones didn't come out correctly because of your genetics, then you can be color ignorant. You may not be able to easily see the difference between the red and the green traffic light because they look almost the same brilliance to a person who doesn't have red perception. But the cones are where it's really happening. And as you take a chunk of steel, for instance, and you can look at it with light shine from the sunlight onto it, and it reflects certain frequencies, shiny frequencies, so to speak, primarily by the electrons. and that comes into your eye as sort of a white, shiny substance, and you say, aha, I recognize that it's steel. You take the chunk of steel into a dark room, and you aim a blowtorch at it. Let me drop it. And what your thermometer measures, what temperature really is the average kinetic energy of the molecules. Those steel molecules are locked together into a matrix. They're fixed in position because it's a solid. But as you heat it up, they're really connected to each other by way of springs, and each individual steel molecule starts vibrating back and forth. And as you heat it up more and more with the blowtorch, they vibrate faster and faster. Eventually, they vibrate fast enough that you see a dim red glow. And as you heat it more, the red glow gets a brighter and brighter red, and eventually becomes yellow, and eventually becomes white, and eventually becomes blue. As you heat it more, and the electron and the individual steel molecules move more violently, they start making higher and higher frequencies of emitted signal, or lower and lower wavelength. And therefore, the green and the blue portion of the cones of your eye start responding, and you say, aha, that has just turned from red to orange to yellow to white to blue, as you make it hotter and hotter. It's the optical spectrometer of the eye with those red, green, and blue cones that's doing most of that action. Let me drop. There are animals that can look into the infrared. A snake, for instance, can do that, and you and I can't. He looks at the heat coming out of that animal in the dark, and he says, aha, that looks, the outline looks just like a mouse. I'm gonna open up my jaws, and I'm going to eat that thing. A bumblebee goes flying around, and he has a very small eye with very small little elements to the eye, which can respond better to the shorter wavelength, and he looks at the world in ultraviolet. That's the reason why the bumblebees don't fly after dusk, because there's not enough ultraviolet coming through the atmosphere when the sun is very low to keep the eyes of the bumblebee working. He's blind at a frequency that you and I are seeing him beautifully, and he can't see you anymore. So each individual animal has individual frequency regions where his eye works because it specializes in his particular environment, where that bumblebee in ultraviolet, many of those flowers that look kind of ordinary to you and I in ultraviolet look very different, and he can easily tell the ones that have the desirable pollen, and he goes for them. So color reception is a beautiful subject, and there's a lot of individual interpretation going on. Which animal is looking at the object, and what color is he going to see? That bumblebee looking at that piece of coal sees something very different than what you see, because his eyes, in order for his survival, specialize a different set of wavelengths. This is some of the story. There's a lot more to it. KC2WGB, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Well, you know, he doesn't understand how color comes from something that has no color. You have to put enough of these atoms together to get something you can see, and then all of a sudden it absorbs certain colors and reflects others. Now, do you think that has anything to do with the natural vibration of the atomic structure, that it absorbs certain colors and reflects others?
Yeah, I think this is now called extinction theory. At the surface of almost every substance, you've got some molecules that when what you and I call light hits them, those molecules absorb and re-radiate. When white light hits, let me pick something, a piece of gold, the molecules at the surface of the gold are free to vibrate in position, and those molecules have a certain amount of mass, a certain amount of spring constant. As such, they more easily vibrate at the red frequencies than the blue frequencies. So the light hits those surface molecules, it sets the light vibrating, believe it or not. The vibration of those surface molecules of the gold, in my example, re-emit those particular frequencies that they resonate at. It's the re-admission of those vibrating molecules on the surface is emitting the signal that your eye sees. You call it reflection. That's a simplification. It's absorption and re-radiation. Very similar to the ionosphere. We call it ionospheric reflection. It's a lot more complicated than that. It's quite a bit of absorption and re-radiation. So that mirror that you think is reflecting all those signals, the surface of that mirror is being excited by that light hitting it. Those surface molecules vibrate, and in the case of the silvery mirrored material, at least across the optical frequencies you and I care about, those molecules are free to oscillate at those particular frequencies and re-radiate those particular frequencies. You start using that mirror in infrared, and you'll see some very, very different phenomena. The mirror was carefully designed to be a good reflector for the optical frequencies. What we call reflection is really absorption and re-radiation. Absorption, vibration, re-radiation.
Repeater, timeout.
WHYY.
And that's a little bit more of the story. Joe, WHYY, go right ahead.
I've only been listening for a couple of minutes here. The gain on high band is lower on the output than it is on the input, and the gain going on the internet is much lower than it used to be. Just letting you know so you can let your technical committee know. Something needs to be adjusted.
Yeah, quite a bit of readjustment of various systems as they added has occurred recently. If Eric happens to be on frequency, maybe he wants to ask you a couple more questions on this. KE2EJ, if you want to pick up, K2LIW in the TechNet. Joe, you said some words that you think Eric would like to know about, so go slow, Joe, and tell us each of the input and output frequencies. What amplitudes did you see, Joe? W2LYY, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, I'm listening to you directly on the input, and you sound louder by a few decibels on the input than you do going over the output. That's number one, directly on high band. Number two, the gain going down the internet, out to the internet to me, is much lower than it used to be, quite a bit. If you want to monitor that, you can take another repeater like your 449125 and put that on this reflector, and you'll see what I'm talking about. That's the only way I can tell you how you can probably monitor something like that. But the gain going out on the IRLP is much lower than it used to be.
You got it, Eric.
I'm kind of aware of that. It'll get taken care of at some point. I'm thinking of it from all this. I've been driving myself crazy. I'm just going to have to wait.
And Eric, your audio was a bit low that time. Joe, did you hear what Eric said?
I know. It's only a hobby.
Yeah. He's got to slacken off a little bit because of all that great big staff of people who are maintaining all of this electronics on 449, 147, 375, 146, 85, of all that great big staff of people that's maintaining all of that electronics, I think 96% of that effort is boiling down to one human being. And you're a guy that's got that smarts. Are you willing to volunteer a little bit? I know you got to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and it's not going to be easy. But H-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-L-I-W.
I don't have the time to do anything.
Yeah, and Eric is trying to maintain a house that he's building and a bunch of broadcast stations he's maintaining and this little thing called ham radio. We got to buy Eric some more hours. KC2WG, you think we can arrange that, John? K2RIW in the TechNet?
Oh, of course, Dick. And don't forget, he's also, in his spare time, he maintains all the voted system. Quite a bit. Kind of late, we should go over to Paul for the space report. But thank you, and it was very interesting. KC2WGB.
Comment. Okay, by the way, about 3 weeks ago, there was one of your guys writing the question about what happens to the air in a tire when the tire is running at 60 miles an hour. And I did a couple of back-of-the-envelope calculations on that. You've got something like, I think it's 1 ounce. I think you got 1 ounce or is it 1 pound? Let me think now. I think it's 1 pound of air in the tire when you include the fact that it's at 28 pounds per square inch. And therefore, twice atmospheric pressure and therefore more air inside. And now you calculate the centrifugal force of the tire rotating at the right number of turns per second that gives you 60 miles an hour. And the bottom line is that because of centrifugal force, the force of the air pressing on the tire, you've got 28 pounds of gauge pressure, 14 pounds per square inch of absolute pressure in the atmosphere. Put it all together, 28 plus 14 is what, 44, 43 pounds per square inch of absolute pressure is hitting the tire before the tire rolls. Now the tire rolls at 60 miles an hour, and you add a very small fraction of 1 pound per square inch of extra pressure on the tire on the inside because of centrifugal force. Because the air is, by your and my standards, such a light material compared to the rubber of the tire and the steel rim and everything else. Let me drop. That increase in pressure is very little. So you think there's going to be a whole lot of swirling air and a whole lot of centrifugal force and whatever, and the tire itself is being deflected periodically because the portion of it touching the road is being punched in and out, so to speak, as far as the air is concerned. But the rotation and the punching are rather minor perturbations compared to the two atmospheres of gauge pressure, three atmospheres of absolute pressure. That's the dominant factor. And as I said here before, air is funny stuff. Something like 70 pounds of it per day has to go through your lungs to keep you alive. More pounds of air than food and water go into your body. And so if you're trying to maintain a bunch of astronauts on the International Space Station, and air is considered somewhat of a consumable product, and you have to continuously bringing up 70 pounds of air per day per astronaut on the International Space Station, and you've got to keep that supply line running, otherwise they're going to be in a lot of trouble. You get a little bit of recycling. Let me drop. The lithium hydroxide filters they use can scrub some of the carbon dioxide out of the air, and you get some recycling, but still it's a continuous supply required. And so if you were going to send an astronaut to the space station, you got to make sure that that Congo line, so to speak, for the next few months and years of supplies of consumables, water, food, and air being the most important one from my point of view, because in 3 minutes you're in a lot of trouble if you don't have it. You got to make sure that's all there. And you now start figuring out what's required to send an astronaut on a 3 or 4 year mission to Mars. And where's all of those consumable raw materials going to come from? You start studying that problem. And you suddenly realize how extremely difficult that is. A naive person saying, I want to see an astronaut in my generation standing on Mars. I doubt it for a long time to come. Wes, you want to make a brief comment on any of the above, K2LIW?
NY2HF would comment on that, Dick.
Talking about the light, the visible light and the comment of John, if it does create any vibration at molecular level, well, actually, visible light is next to the ultraviolet, and it's partially creating the electronic excitation, which would be temporary bond of two atoms altogether, but only for the temporary, it's nothing permanent. The microwave is creating rotation, infrared is vibration, and the X-ray is creating the bond breaking, so the photon of each one of the bandwidth creates a certain phenomena. So when John was talking about it, he mentioned that actually we're dealing with a photon, which doesn't have polarity and doesn't have a mass, which I know that you know. But, if we're talking about the light and the color, then each color has its own wavelength, so red would be longer than the violet, and the violet would be shorter one. So the more we're going in it, the more this electromagnetic wave resonates with our electromagnetic wave detector, and this is our eye. But that's my comment in it. And to exchange.
Don't forget the space report, Dick.
Roger. I'm going to add a couple of words to this one.